I've been asked to address some thoughts on the essence of Tisha B'Av, in particular to youth, to teenagers, and those who are of the younger generation trying to make sense a little bit out of this experience of Tisha B'Av, trying to draw some meaning from sitting on the floor and engaging in an entire day devoted to mourning for a temple that stood thousands of years ago. There's a famous story that I would like to open with of Napoleon, that as he was traveling through Europe and he was found himself in the city of Paris, that he saw a building, a Beis HaKnesses, a shul, and Napoleon approached the shul and it was late at night, and peering through the windows, he noticed that there was a group of people sitting on the floor of this synagogue, sitting on the floor of this house of prayer, and they were sitting with candles and they had books in their hands, and there was an emotional tone to their gathering. He heard crying, he heard lamenting. And so he brought one of his captains over, he brought one of his officers over, and he asked the officer, please go into the room, go into the synagogue, and try to determine what exactly is going on here. And so the soldier proceeded to enter the synagogue, and he went over to one of the individuals who was sitting on the floor. He tapped him on the shoulder. He asked him to come to the back so he could ask him a question. And the soldier approached the individual, this older Jew, and he said to him, what's going on here? I have this great general, this great emperor Napoleon outside. He sees that there is this house of worship with people sitting on the floor, crying with candles, lamenting with prayer books. And he's very astounded because that's not usually what prayer looks like. Normally, prayer is something that has, you know, sort of a sense of devotion, a sense of meditation, perhaps silence, standing, reflection. What is this sadness that seems to be permeating your gathering? And so the old man looks at the soldier and he says, tonight is the night of Tisha B'Av. It is a night where we remember the destruction of our temple. And so the soldier, in hearing this, he says to the individual, he says to the old Jew, tell me, where is this temple that was destroyed? We haven't come across any ruins, any ashes, any place of destruction. Where is this temple that's been destroyed? And so the old man says to the soldier, he says, no, you don't understand. The temple that was destroyed thousands of years ago. It is not standing, it hasn't been standing in many, many generations. And the soldier, somewhat perplexed, returned to Napoleon and he relates the story of the old man and he tells the emperor they are mourning the temple that used to be the center of their Jewish life, that used to be the place of communal gathering where they worshiped their God, where their leader spoke to them, where they studied their laws and their ethics and morals and ideals. They are mourning this temple that was destroyed. And Napoleon says, where was this temple? Where is this destroyed temple? We haven't come across any ruins all throughout Europe. And the older man who had related to the soldier, so the soldier says to Napoleon, that the temple that was destroyed 2,000 years ago, or at the time, probably 1,500 years ago. And so Napoleon responds after some reflection, and he says to the soldier, a nation that could still feel, a nation that could still sense this type of emotional connection, this type of experiential connection to something that stood thousands of years ago, that is a nation that will endure, that is a nation that ultimately will merit to see their temple one day stand again. And in truth, sometimes it's very difficult for us to relate to the world of Tisha B'Av. It's like the story of the two soldiers, the paratroopers who, after liberating the city of Yerushalayim in 1967, are walking down towards the Kotel HaMaravi, towards the wall. One of these soldiers is a soldier who had the good fortune to grow up in the atmosphere of Torah, in the atmosphere of a religious home. And the other soldier, a wonderful hero of the Jewish people who didn't have the opportunity to grow up in such an environment, and so he was not a religious fellow. And they are walking together towards the Kotel, towards the Western Wall, well aware of the historical significance of what they had just accomplished, knowing that they had just liberated a city that for thousands of years stood outside the reach of the Jewish people. And after the months of anticipation and stress, and unbelievable fear, and after the days of miraculous battle, and after losing so many of their close friends in the liberation of Yerushalayim, they approach the Western Wall, they approach the Kotel, and they are both crying. And the non-religious soldier turns to the religious soldier and he says, why are you crying? And the religious soldier says, I'm crying because for years I have said in every one of my prayers, Yerushalayim ircha berachamim tashuv, For so many years I have prayed for us to return to this spot, to this place. And I sense the holiness, I sense the Kedusha. I sense the presence of my grandparents and great-grandparents. I sense the presence of my forefathers, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, of Sarah, Leah, Rivka, and Rachel. I sense the presence of all the generations of Jews that cried tears to have the opportunity to stand at the Kotel HaMaravi and would never merit to do have such an opportunity. And so therefore I cry in appreciation for what we have missed for so many thousands of years, in anticipation for the meaning of this dramatic event. But then the religious soldier turns to his friend and he says, "Why are you crying?" And the soldier looks into the eyes of his religious fellow soldier and he says to him, "I'm crying because I don't even know what there is to cry about. I'm crying because I lack the perspective. I lack the context. I lack the appreciation of what it is that we're standing in front of." And I think that even though so many of us have grown up with the opportunity to appreciate what Yerushalayim is all about, to appreciate the significance of the Kotel HaMaravi, to have traveled to Israel on trips with family, with friends, with a youth group, and even though so many of us have prayed three times a day for the return of Jerusalem, I think for many of us, as teenagers today, the experience of Tisha B'Av is probably more reminiscent of the non-religious soldier. That we sit on the ground of our shuls, we sit on the floors of our homes, and we try to connect with this temple that stood thousands of years ago. But in fact, even if we could manage through the emotion of the day to shed some sort of tear, for so many of us it feels like we don't even know what we're crying about. And like we're the ones peering into the window of the shul in Paris, wondering with amazement as people are able to connect to a temple that stood so many thousands of years ago. When in the framework of our modern life, when in the world of Facebook and Twitter, with our iPods and our DVD players, and all of the elements that comprise our everyday teenage life, it is so difficult for us to connect to this world of Yerushalayim, to this world of the destruction of the temple. Firstly, the Beis HaMikdash stood so many years ago. We are growing up in a world that is moving at 95 miles an hour. We are growing up in a world, I just recently had the opportunity to see a video of a newscast that took place in 1990, where they were reflecting on the notion that there is going to be something called the internet that is evolving in the context of modern life, and that one day we may be able to do the bulk of our shopping on this thing called the internet. 1990, not that long ago. We are growing up in a world that is very fast-paced. The 21st century is flying with technological advances, with everything moving forward. And to us, the world of 10 or 15 years ago seems like ancient antiquity. And so to be able to connect to a temple that stood thousands of years ago, we're not talking about black and white television. We're talking about something that is so far out of the reach of our imagination that it is incredibly challenging for us to develop some sort of emotional connection to this experience. Secondly, even that Beis HaMikdash, even when we have the opportunity to see the replicas, the museums in Israel that depict the different clothing of the Kohanim and the various vessels that stood in the Beis HaMikdash and the models of the Beis HaMikdash, even with the greatest multimedia presentations, even with the most dramatic depictions of what the Beis HaMikdash used to be like, it was a service that is so foreign to us. We can relate to a shul, to a tefillah service, to davening, to a chazan, to someone leading the prayers, to a rabbi giving an inspiring sermon, to the environment of a synagogue. But the temple, as we read about it, as we study it, its laws, its rituals seem so foreign to us. The notion of animal sacrifice is something that we are reaching back to try to cry about, that it's something that's not at the center of our lives. It's very, very difficult. The entire service of the Beis HaMikdash seems like something that's so foreign to us. And the tone of the entire day, it almost feels like out of nowhere, we're pulled from a summer of touring, of camping, of recreation, of having a good time with our friends, whether we're on an Israel tour, you know, climbing Masada, rappelling in the Golan, whether we're, you know, crossing America with all sorts of friends, whether we're hanging out in camp, playing ball, whatever it is, and all of a sudden we are sucked into this time warp where we're told today we're going to focus on the loss of the Beis HaMikdash from 2,000 years ago. And it seems so contrived. We're told to sit on the floor. We're told we have to be what feels like impolite to people. Finally, a day that we don't have to say hello. We can't say hello. We can't greet people. We can't wash. We can't do all sorts of things that, you know, that just seem so manufactured emotionally. And, you know, to just transform immediately from the fun and excitement and enthusiasm of summer all of a sudden into this world of sitting on the floor and mourning, it's very difficult. It's a very difficult transition to make. And perhaps most challenging for many of us is the liturgy of the day, the kinos. You know, if you want to get the youth involved, make a Haggadah. The Haggadah is something we could understand. We sit around the Pesach table. There are so many books and so many explanations, thousands and thousands of commentaries that have been written on the Haggadah. There are interactive components of the Haggadah. There are stories, there are halakhic components, there is music, there's song. There is so many different components to the Pesach Seder experience. There is active components, we're eating different foods. There is a sense of incentive with the Afikomen. There is a real move to try to get the youth involved. Then we come to Tisha B'Av and they hand us this book called Kinos. It's almost impossible to get through the first three lines of Kinos. This archaic, poetic language that barely resonates with people who are experts in Jewish liturgy. And we are supposed to, in our teenage lives, open this book and find meaning and inspiration in these words, in these Kinos. It is so difficult. And so now we live in a generation where to solve this problem, the rabbis of all our synagogues, myself included, decided that the best way to make Kinos more exciting is to speak for 4 hours. And so now, not only are we sitting on the floor with a book we don't understand, but now we're sitting here listening to rabbis pontificate for 4 or 5 hours, lengthening the service till 12 or 1 o'clock. Let's be honest. For so many of us, this is an incredibly difficult day. Tisha B'Av is one of those days where we just want it to be over. Where if we could set our watch on a backwards clock at 25 hours, so it lets us know when the final hour is here, we would be elated. That moment where you finally get to Mincha and you realize you're only a couple hours away from being able to bite into a bagel or have your, you know, stomach full of some nash or some, you know, good food. It is a very, very challenging day. And so what I would like to do is share with you one dimension of Tisha B'Av that I believe is really at the essence of what youth could connect to on a day like this. Perhaps it's not the standard aspect of Tisha B'Av that is at the forefront of so much of the experience, or what even most or many of the rituals are trying to engender within us. But nevertheless, it's a very dominant theme throughout Tisha B'Av in terms of its import, in terms of its depth, even though it expresses itself in very subtle ways. And I really believe that if we can connect to this component of Tisha B'Av, that a day that we find incredibly challenging, and for some of us even excruciatingly painful, it could become a day that really is a source of great strength and inspiration for the youth of our generation. First of all, you should know that the Gemara understood, Chazal already understood, and they did not live so long after Tisha B'Av, that this is a very difficult concept to connect to. An ancient destruction. We are told, and it is quoted in Shulchan Aruch, "Mishenichnas Av mimaatim b'simcha," that when Av arrives, when the month of Av arrives, we are to diminish our expressions of joy. And one could ask, what's with the mimaatim? What's with the diminishing? Why don't you just say, you know, "Asur lismoach b'chodesh Av"? Just put it on the table. There are going to be various laws, there are going to be various restrictions in which we curtail the expressions of happiness, of joy that are part of our daily life, and therefore those halachic requirements are going to express themselves throughout the month of Av, and that should express a certain degree of preclusion from happiness in Av. Asur lismoach b'chodesh Av. You are not allowed to be happy in the month of Av. What's mima'atin b'simcha? So the truth is that Chazal understood that you can't flip a switch. You can't walk off the baseball field into Eicha. You can't just walk out of the world of summer into the world of Tisha B'Av. And the Gemara in Yevamos distinguishes between what is called Avelus Yeshana and Avelus Chadasha. What is Avelus Chadasha? Avelus Chadasha is a new mourning. It is a mourning, a reflection on something sad that occurred recently. Something that we could still feel and appreciate the depth of the loss. A loss of a loved one. A national calamity. Something that is literally part of our very soul. The way some of us are emotionally awakened every year in September, when it seems to be that the memories of that infamous day of 9/11 come back. The way many of us feel around the time of year where we remember various relatives who we had a close relationship with that are no longer with us. But we remember sitting on their lap, and we remember spending time with them, and we remember hanging out with them, and we remember playing ball with them, we remember going to shul with them. They're a part of our life. They're a part of our living memory. That's Avelus Chadasha. And when tragedy strikes, the rabbis gave us a structure, the Torah gave us a structure to try to deal with that tragedy, to try to take control of our emotions. And the mourning diminishes over time. We are first plunged into the world of Aninos, into the world of confrontation with the loss, and then into the world of Shiva, of the 7 days of mourning, where there are many, many laws of mourning about not sitting on a chair and not wearing all sorts of clothing and wearing ripped clothing, and certain halachos regarding how we act, staying in our home. And then slowly we emerge from this period of mourning into Shloshin, the 30-day mourning period, and this 12-month mourning period, because we're trying to pull ourselves out of the loss. Because we don't need assistance. We don't need halacha to help us feel this sense of something missing, the void in our life. It's emotional. We feel it on our own. But when we look at something else, in contrast to this, the Gemara talks about Avelus Yeshana. Avelus Yeshana is mourning for something that happened a long time ago. Something that we don't feel the immediate impact of, like the loss of the temple, the loss of the Beis HaMikdash. And for this, the sense of mourning actually increases, inverse to the sense of mourning that happens for Avelus Chadasha. And so therefore we begin with the 3 weeks, where we have some halachot that govern the way we conduct ourselves in terms of different things that are curtailed, weddings and the like. We move to the 9 days, and from the 9 days to the week of Tisha B'Av, and from the week of Tisha B'Av to Tisha B'Av itself. And the mourning is increasing in impact in order to help guide our emotions to that particular place. So, first thing that is most important to recognize is that if we don't open our minds and our hearts, if we don't allow ourselves to be somewhat affected by what these gradual increases in the laws of mourning are trying to create in our emotional life, then we can't be surprised when Tisha B'Av comes and it's so difficult to connect ourselves to the sensitivity of the loss of the Beis HaMikdash. Chazal understood that this was not going to come naturally. Nevertheless, as difficult as it is, we have to try to connect. So I want to share with you a dimension of Tisha B'Av that I'm not sure many of you are aware of. The fact that Tisha B'Av actually, in the context of Tanakh, and this is picked up on in Halacha as well, is actually referred not only as a day, is actually referred to not only as a day of great mourning and of great tragedy, as we read in the Parsha of the Miraglim of the spies, when the Jewish people cry upon hearing the reports of the spies of Israel, that they cried, and Rashi tells us, the Gemara tells us, Tem bechisem bechia shachinam, you cried for naught because I promised you that you'd succeed in conquering Israel. Ani ekva lechem bechia ledoros, I will establish for you a day of crying for generations. And with that, Tisha B'Av became endowed as a day that is designated a Yom Muchan, a day that is predisposed to Jewish tragedy, and there have been many tragedies throughout Jewish history that have not inconsequentially been associated and ended up falling out on Tisha B'Av itself. And therefore, Tisha B'Av is, of course, retains this identity of being a day of great mourning, of great sadness. But Tisha B'Av is actually also surprisingly referred to as a moed, as a holiday. This is very shocking. This is very perplexing. Why would you take a day where you have me sitting on the floor, reciting kinos, listening to the rabbi talk for hours and hours about the tragedies of Jewish history, kinos about the Beis HaMikdash, kinos about the Crusades, kinos about the Holocaust, trying to reflect on all of the tragedies of Jewish history, why would you take a day like that and refer to it as a moed, as a holiday? Holidays are days of joy, days of simcha. Holidays are days where the family convenes, where we celebrate in the synagogue, where we dance, where we sing, where we congregate together. That's where the word moed comes from, Eidah, the congregation, we're coming together. There are days where the entire Jewish people would go up to the Beis HaMikdash, do Aliyah L'Regel. There are days of Jewish unity. There are days of joy and happiness. In what way can you associate that with Tisha B'Av? So the truth is, not only is Tisha B'Av referred to as a moed, but this actually has consequences in Jewish law, as we are told in the Shulchan Aruch, that in fact, Ein Omrim Tachanun B'Tisha B'Av, Ve'ein Noflin Al Paneya Mishum D'Mikri Moed. That because Tisha B'Av is called a moed, because Tisha B'Av is referred to as a holiday, we actually do not recite Tachanun on Tisha B'Av. As if it's the day that we have a chasan, a groom in the shul. As if it's a day of a bris milah. As if it's a day of Yom Tov. It's a day of moed. It does not receive Tachanun. We are also told that Mashiach was born on Tisha B'Av. That it's a day of great moed. It's a day of great celebration. And in truth, we know that as the day proceeds, even though the Beis HaMikdash burned with greater force towards the end of the day of Tisha B'Av and into the next day, the laws of the Avelus, the laws of the mourning, actually begin to lift and begin to diminish. That Tisha B'Av takes on a character that is not exclusively sad. That Tisha B'Av has an element to it that is not only rooted in sitting on the floor and wallowing in the tragedy and suffering of Jewish history, that there is an element of Tisha B'Av that is focused not just on the past, but also on the future. Not just on the destruction, but also on the potential. Not just on the worst of times, but also on the notion that we all know that sometimes the worst of times bring out the best in the Jewish people. And there's a famous Gemara. The Gemara tells the story of Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah and Rabbi Yoshua and Rabbi Akiva, who were walking at the site of the destruction of the temple. And says the Gemara, Kevan shi'igiu laharabayis, when they arrived at the site of Harabayis, of the Temple Mount, ra'u shu'ol shi'yatsa mi'beis kodshei kadoshim. They saw a fox emerge from the Kodesh HaKadoshim, from the Holy of Holies. Hizchilu hein bochim. And so all of the rabbis began to cry at this site of destruction, the site of total desolation of the temple to the extent that even the fox is roaming. And Rabbi Akiva mitzachik, Rabbi Akiva, in what must have been a very awkward moment, begins to laugh. Amru lo, they say to Rabbi Akiva, mipnei ma'ata mitzachik, Rabbi Akiva, why are you laughing? Omar Lahem, he responds to them, Mipnei Ma'atem Bochim. Typical rabbi responds a question with a question. Why are you crying? So they say, Omru lo, Mokom Shekosuv bo, Vahazora Korev Yumas. This is the spot where the Torah tells us that if anyone enters the temple site, this geographic location, they are liable to the penalty of death. There is so much holiness saturated in this place. And now, we are in a situation, v'achshav shulin olchim bo v'lo nivke. Now we're in a situation where foxes can just roam the site of the Beis HaMikdash. Should we not cry? Is this not something to be incredibly sad and depressed about? Amar lahen, Rabbi Akiva looks at them and says, lochein l'kach ani mitzachik. That is precisely the source and the origin of my laughter. Because he says that it says in Yeshayahu that a Kadosh Baruch Hu cites the characters of Uriah and Zechariah as his witnesses, and asks the Gemara, "V'chima inyon Uriah etzel Zechariah? What is the association of the personality of Uriah with Zechariah? After all, we know that Uriah b'mikdash rishon v'Zechariah b'mikdash sheni." Uriah lived at the time of the first temple, and Zechariah at the time of the second. Ela tola akosuv nevioso shel Zechariah benevuoso shel Uriah. But the Torah wanted to create a connection, a dependency of the prophecy of Uriah to the prophecy of Zechariah. Be Uriah ksiv lachem biglalchem tzion sadeti choresh. Uriah speaks of the desolation, of the destruction, of Tzion, of Yerushalayim being plowed over. But Zechariah speaks. Od yeshvu zekenim uzekenos berchavos Yerushalayim. Zechariah speaks of the hope. Zechariah speaks of the dream. Zechariah speaks of the future. Zechariah speaks of the potential of the Jewish people to rise up from this desolation and recreate and reconstruct and reinvigorate an entire world of Torah. Ad shlo niskayma nivuaso shel Uriah hayisi misyore shlo tiskayim nivuaso shel Zechariah. Says Rabbi Akiva, as we were living in the generation of great oppression and great anti-Semitism, I always feared that the nevuah of Zechariah, the nevuah of reconstruction of hope, would not find fruition. But now that I see Achshav sheniskayma nevuaso shel Uriah, now that I see the fox roaming the desolation of the temple, biyadua shenevuaso shel Zechariah miskayemes, I know with certitude that the nevuah of Zechariah, the nevuah of hope, will be one that will come to fruition. Biloshon hazeh amrula. And the rabbis standing with Rabbi Akiva, the leaders of the Jewish people, those who were most traumatized by the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, look at Rabbi Akiva, and they say to him, you have completely transformed our Tisha B'Av experience. You have completely uprooted our approach, our perspective, Akiva Nichamtanu, Akiva Nichamtanu. Rabbi Akiva, you have comforted us. You have given us hope. You have given us vision. You have given us clarity, and you have given us something to look forward to. Tisha B'Av is not just about the past. Tisha B'Av is not just about destruction. Tisha B'Av is also about the future. Tisha B'Av is not just about looking back and wallowing and lamenting. It is also about Bitseisi Mimitzrayim. It is also about the world of redemption. It is also a moed. It is also a forward-looking and hopeful day that, yes, has a piece of it that requires us to appreciate the context of Jewish history, that requires us to appreciate where we're coming from, that there was a world of destruction, that the Babylonians and the Romans and the Crusades and the Nazis all sought to destroy the Jewish people. But it is also a day of moed. It is also a day of gathering. It's also a day of Jewish unity. It is also a day where when you peer in through the windows of that shul in Paris, you see a nation that has endured all of this oppression and despite all the challenges and despite all the suffering, continues to be able to maintain and preserve and promote their ideals and values to the rest of the world. Share with you an incredible story that is told about Hanukkah in the concentration camp of Bergen-Belsen. That there was a famous incident where Hanukkah came, and unfortunately one of the Nazi guards decided that this would be an opportune time for what was called a selection. And he walked into the barracks of the Blujava Rebbe, Rav Spira, and he began to point randomly at various Jews, the emaciated Jews of the concentration camp, and he began to say, you, with no rhyme or reason, with no sense of selectivity, with no sense of why you and not you, and just an entire, just barbaric approach. And he brought out this group of people, and they beat them, and they beat them, until they were bruised and until they had passed out, and whatever they couldn't accomplish with the beatings, they accomplished with the revolver. And at the end of the day, nightfall came. And one of the people in the barracks approached the Blujava Rebbe and he said to him, Rav Spira Rebbe, tonight is the first night of Hanukkah. Is there any way that we can get together and light the Hanukkah candles? Of course, not having a menorah, not having a candle, not having oil, not having a wick, they began to be as resourceful as possible. And they used their ingenuity and they used a shoe to be the menorah and they used black polish to serve as the oil. And one of the members of the concentration camp pulled a piece of thread out of their prisoner uniform and fashioned a wick. And they constructed this makeshift menorah and placed it in front of the Blujava Rebbe. The Rebbe approached the menorah with a candle late at night, and all of a sudden he began to recite the brachos, the blessings on the menorah. And the Rebbe recited the first blessing, praising God for commanding us to light the Hanukkah candles. And then he blessed the second blessing, that thanks God for the miracles that he has done for the Jewish people throughout the generations, no doubt, closing his eyes in deep prayer and deep desire for the Ribbono Shel Olam to somehow replicate those level of miracles for the people imprisoned in this horror in the concentration camp. And then the Rebbe came to the third bracha that we make on the first night of Chanukah, the bracha of Shechiyonu. And the Rebbe looked at the menorah and he hesitated. And he looked around at all of the Jews watching him holding the candle. And he hesitated an extra moment. And then with deep devotion and tears running down his eyes, the Rebbe began to make the bracha, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam. Blessed are you, God, King of the Universe. Shechiyanu v'kiyamanu v'higiyanu lazman hazeh. That you have brought us and sustained us to this particular time. And he lit the menorah. One of the Jews standing around pulls over the Rebbe and he says, I don't understand. Look around us. We are in a living hell. We are only moments following our friends, our community members, our family members being randomly pulled from their beds and executed for no rhyme or reason. We are in the midst of the greatest destruction and suffering that the Jewish people have ever experienced. And you're standing at the menorah lighting the candles. I understand you made the first bracha. I understand you made the second bracha. And you are standing at the menorah and lighting a candle and reciting Shechiyanu v'kiyamanu v'higiyanu lazman hazeh. You are praising God for bringing us to this moment. I don't understand. And the Rebbe looked into the eyes of the prisoner. And he said to him, I have to be honest with you. I also hesitated before reciting this blessing. I agree with you. My emotions had me in the exact same place. How could we make a blessing? Shechiyanu v'kiyamanu v'higiyanu lazman hazeh. And then I looked around. And I saw the eyes and the faces of Jews who had been beaten, who had been persecuted, whose family members had been taken in the middle of the night, who did not know if they would live to see the second Hanukkah candle. And I saw them standing around at great, great risk to their very lives, only for the purpose of ensuring the endurance of the Jewish people. The Jewish people's charge to illuminate the world with the light of the Hanukkah candles. The Hanukkah candles which we put in our doorways and in our windowsills to show the world that we believe in our ideals and values. We're proud of them. We have a Jewish pride that even in the world of Bergen-Belsen, we are willing to make such a statement. And so, dear Jews, I did not make the blessing of Shechiyanu necessarily on the lighting of the candle. I made the blessing of Shechiyanu on all of you. Shechiyanu v'kiyamanu v'higiyanu lazman hazeh. That we have a Jewish people with such strength, with such fortitude, with such hope, with such conviction, that we are willing to light a Hanukkah candle in the midst of a concentration camp. That, dear youth, is the message of the Moed of Tisha B'Av. That's what it means to have a day of mourning that's also a day of celebration. A day of recognition of the endurance and strength of the Jewish people. A day where you realize that you are part of something bigger, something that you have great pride in. A day where you recognize that even though throughout the momentum of our everyday life, we are so focused on having a good time, maybe a little bit on learning, a little bit on growing. We are so focused on having new experiences, on spending time with our friends, on hanging out, on knowing what's cool and what's not, and getting involved in sports and movies and everything else that becomes part of our life. But for one day a year, for one day a year, Chazal asks us, you know what? Take a moment and realize where you're coming from. And it's not just about suffering. And it's not just about sitting on the floor. Because you better make sure you're still in that synagogue at 12 or 1 o'clock when you get up off the floor. Because that is what Tisha B'Av is all about. It's all about sitting on the ground and lamenting and crying for the millions and millions of Jews who've given their families and their very lives and their futures to sustain the Jewish people to the tragedies of history. And then despite all of the oppression and despite all of the attacks, getting up off the floor and sitting on a chair and not reciting Tachanun. And sitting up with our heads full of pride and lighting that menorah in our windowsill. you know that it's a fascinating kli, the menorah. It's a fascinating vessel of the Beis HaMikdash. I'll tell you something very beautiful. The menorah was lit by the Kohen every single day. In order to light the menorah, you need to be in the Beis HaMikdash. But the Rambam writes that a zar, someone who is not a Kohen, is permitted to light the menorah. Had lokas a menorah in the Beis HaMikdash, the lighting of the menorah that the Chashmonaim did with the big miracle, with the whole deal, and the miracle of Hanukkah, that can be done by any Jew. It doesn't have to be a Kohen, it doesn't have to be a Levi, it doesn't have to be a rabbi. Any Jew, a zar, can light the menorah. There's a logistical problem, because a standard Jew cannot enter the Beis HaMikdash. So says the Rambam, that if a Kohen brings the menorah outside the Beis HaMikdash, and a regular Jew lights the menorah, and then he brings it back into the Beis HaMikdash, we have fulfilled our mitzvah of lighting the menorah in the temple. Because the menorah symbolizes our Jewish pride. The menorah symbolizes the fire that burns, the illumination. The menorah symbolizes that this is not just about us. This is about the entire world. This is about feeling a sense of pride, a sense of dignity, a sense that we have something to offer the world. And that's not just in the domain of the Kohen. That belongs to every single Jew. Yes, in order for it to be situated in the Beis HaMikdash, there is a technicality. You need the Kohen to bring it out and bring it back in for a variety of other reasons. But it doesn't need a Kohen to light the fire. You don't need a rabbi to light the fire. You don't need a priest to light the fire. You don't need a Levi to light the fire. Any Jew can light that flame. Whether it's the Blujava Rebbe sitting in Bergen-Belsen, whether it's the Jews sitting on the floor of Paris while Napoleon peers in through the windows of the synagogue, whether it's the two friends who have just conquered the Kotel HaMaravi, mutually inspiring each other, or whether it's you. Whether it's you asking yourself, what have you done and what do you intend to do to carry on the legacy of these people? What in your life is going to be the moed of Tisha B'Av? How are you going to ensure that a trip to Yad Vashem is not just reflecting on the past, but is an inspirational force for your future? How are you going to make sure that all of those Jews who add to make the sacrifice of Kiddush Hashem, that add to sanctify God's name in their death, that their memory and their legacy will survive and thrive in the Jewish people through you, who have merited to be able to serve God not through the medium of sacrifice, but through the medium of life? It's one thing to die al Kiddush Hashem, it's a whole nother ballgame to live al Kiddush Hashem. Where is our Jewish pride? Whether it's walking down the halls of a public school, whether it's walking throughout the halls of a yeshiva high school, whether it's walking outside, whether it's at a ballpark, whether it's in a mall, no matter where you find yourself, where is our pride to be Jewish? And where have we managed to take the lessons and ideals that these people died for? And the destruction that came as a result of? Where is our ambition to move our people forward? It's a fascinating statistic, you know, that the most commonly observed Jewish ritual is not Yom Kippur, and it's not the Pesach Seder. The most commonly observed Jewish ritual, according to the National Jewish Population Survey, is lighting Hanukkah candles. Because in the heart of every Jew, no matter how far or close they are to the world of Torah, in the heart of every Jew is that fire, that desire, that passion to cry over what's been lost in the past and to be sure that we will perpetuate the legacy of the past and the ideals that we have for the future. And so, yes, for the youth, Tisha B'Av is an entirely different experience. It's not just about sitting on the floor. It's about getting up off the floor and trying to figure out how we're going to live our lives in a way that makes the sacrifice of the past something meaningful for the future. And so I wish all of you not only a meaningful Tisha B'Av, not only that you should find some sense of connection, some sense of emotion, some sense of inspiration in the Avelos, in the morning of Tisha B'Av, but I wish you a good Yontif. I wish you a good Moed. That you should find the celebration in Tisha B'Av. That you should find in your own personal lives where suffering, where challenge can give birth to opportunity, where a overwhelmingly devastating experience can give you a chance to laugh at the vision of Zechariah, that od yeshvu zekenim uzekenos, that we will one day see a world that is completely rebuilt, a world where the Jewish people are not on the run, a world where the Jewish people don't have to live in fear and trepidation, a world where the Jewish people don't have to negotiate what will be with the future of their land, a world of true redemption, where the moed of Tisha B'Av can expand to comprise the entire experience. And that is a world that you can bring to this generation. You who lack the cynicism and the life experience of the adult world, you who are still in your years of idealism and the opportunity to believe, the arrogance to believe that you can do anything because you can, and you won't let anyone tell you otherwise. You are the ones that can bring the Mashiach. You are the ones that can bring the ultimate redemption to the Jewish people. All you have to do is look inside yourself and find where your place in the Jewish people ultimately is going to be. And I wish you the greatest of fortune and the greatest of success in that ambition. I wish you a meaningful Tisha B'Av, and may this be our final Tisha B'Av mourning the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And may we all merit to stand at the ultimate rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, where we can witness the entire grandeur of that experience and live in peace with each other as a unified Jewish people. Have a wonderful, wonderful day.